Welcome to all of you. I want to talk about my guru. I also want to talk about how to find your guru, because this is a very important aspect of the spiritual path. And I found my guru in a very unusual way, because I didn't know anything. I had read no spiritual books. I had done a great deal of thinking, but I had not read because I didn't think anybody knew what he was talking about. This was my arrogance. I didn't think I knew what I was talking about, but I didn't think anybody did. I thought that God must be some sort of incomprehensible reality beyond any human reasoning. There's a story about a young man who went to a great saint and asked to be accepted as his disciple. And the great saint said, "Come with me." And he took him down to a river, and he pushed his head under water. And the young man was spluttering, and finally the saint let him up. He said, "What did you want more than anything else when you were down there, submerged underwater?" And the young man gasped, "Air, air." He said, "When you want God like that, come back." We have to really long for God. Sri Yukteswar, in his book, The Holy Science, says that when the heart's natural love unfolds, that is when we are ready to find our guru. Now, my love when I was young was for truth, but it was not enough of a heart quality. And yet I was like that young man. I was desperate. People had wanted me to do all the usual things. I was brought up in a well-to-do home, and they wanted me to get a good job and marry and settle down in a nice home and have nice neighbors and nice this and nice that and nice the other thing. And I thought, I could not imagine a worse nightmare for me than to live such a life of what to me was mediocrity. I wanted to do something that would change my life, that would change other people's lives, something that would uplift. And I went through all sorts of different ways of seeking, and nothing succeeded in satisfying me. I couldn't find it through science, because I found that science is only of the mind, but they can never reach out and become anything. It's all just ideas, and they keep changing their ideas. Every decade or so, some major scientific dogma is tossed aside for some other new dogma. I wanted to be a musician. People wanted me to be a singer. And I thought, what will I sing? I took music lessons. I remember she was a very good teacher. After 6 months, she stopped me in the middle of a song. She said, "That note, that's how all your notes should sound." She was very conscientious. But I thought, what shall I sing? This is sheer nonsense. All the songs in classical repertoire are the same old bilge. "I loved her and she let me down and I feel betrayed," or that sort of thing. Absolute. I thought, why should I waste my life just showing off my voice while the message that I'm giving people doesn't mean anything? And so I wanted nothing to do with that. And I wanted to be a playwright. And I thought that if I could write plays, and many people thought I would be a front-ranking playwright in America. And I gradually realized that what I wanted was to give people truth, and I didn't know truth. And so why should I flood the world with my ignorance? And I gave up writing, and I gave up music, I gave up writing, I gave up this, I gave up that. And finally I thought, well, where am I headed? And I remember taking a long walk out into the night one evening. I was down in Charleston, South Carolina, at the Dock Street Theater learning stagecraft. And I took this long walk, and I was thinking, what is God? If there is a God, what must he be? And I thought, well, he can't be some policeman up there waiting for us to do something wrong so he can clap us into hell. There's got to be some deeper meaning to it. And I thought, well, what is it that helps me to, that makes me think about what is God? It must be, why am I conscious? It can't just be my brain. I am conscious, and therefore I can think. That's where Descartes had it wrong. He said, I think, therefore I am. No, I am, and therefore I can think. I'm conscious of being, and therefore I'm able to think. Consciousness precedes everything. And I began to think that in that case, he is consciousness. And my consciousness must be a tiny little reflection of his consciousness. And if this is true, then what our job and duty is in life is to be more in tune with that consciousness, because I had learned in my life that when I was more open to that, then I was more clear, I could understand things better, and when I was close to it, I couldn't understand anything. And so my duty was to try to attune myself with God. And I remember I came back, I was sharing an apartment with four other young men, and I came back and I was so thrilled with this staggering concept. I had never read it anywhere, but I didn't know it was the true teaching of Vedanta. I just had that in my samskaras, but I didn't know it. And I remember they were trying to joke with me, and it was too deep. And I decided that I must seek God. Well, I didn't know. I didn't know that anybody had ever sought God. I thought, this must be absolute madness. Am I going crazy? And then I thought, well, at least I must try to get myself under control. And I used to smoke, so I tried to give up smoking. Well, it was like what Mark Twain said, that smoking is the easiest habit in the world to give up. I've done it 1,000 times. And so I would quit, except that with that coffee after a meal, it tasted so good. So I ended up going back to smoking. But here was the trick that helped me. And it's a very important little mental trick to understand. Whenever I went back to smoking, I did not say, I have failed. I said, I have not yet succeeded. So that every failure was an affirmation of ultimate success. And I remember after a year of this, going up and down and up and down, finally one day I said to one of my roommates, I'm not smoking anymore. And he said, I've heard that one before. Well, I meant it. And I carried around a half-empty packet of cigarettes in my pocket, gave them out to my friends. From then on, I have never had the slightest desire to smoke. I remember I was in New York. I had to leave there because my mother was going to Egypt to join my father. He'd been posted to Cairo to seek oil there. That was his job. And I went into a bar on Fifth Avenue because it was very hot in the summertime, and I wanted a nice cooling beer. So I had two nice cooling beers, and it didn't make me drunk, but I noticed that after those two beers, I wasn't quite as clear as I had been before those two beers. So I said, all right, no more drinking. And I never had the slightest desire to drink. I never had a problem with drinking anyway, but it just never entered my mind again. And bit by bit, I kept trying to sort of discipline myself. And then I thought, no, I must be going crazy. This is absolute madness to seek God. Who's ever found God? I didn't know about the lives of saints and all those things. And so I decided I would go up into the beautiful countryside of northern New York and maybe amid the beauties of nature, I would find what I was looking for, peace of mind or something, I didn't know what. And I found that people in the country were just as stupid, if not more so, than people in the cities. Worst of all, I myself couldn't really relate to anything. It was as if there was this barrier of ego that prevented me from entering into the beauties around me. I could see intellectually, yes, they're beautiful, but I couldn't feel them. And I remember I had to come back to put my mother on the ship. And the very day that I put her on the ship, I went uptown New York, and I found in a bookstore on Fifth Avenue, I found Autobiography of a Yogi. And that book just absolutely, an expression blew my mind. It really did. It was incredible. I'd never heard of words like guru and yoga and karma and dharma and all these things Indian. I didn't know anything about it. I never thought that I might need a guru because I didn't think anybody knew anything. But when I read this book, I thought, here finally is somebody I can trust. And I remember he said he was a vegetarian, so I immediately gave up meat. And I was invited to dinner at the home of some friends of our family. And they gave us chicken a la king for lunch. So I carefully moved the chicken apart and just had the vegetables. But the next day, I was invited out to another friend. They were trying to take care of me because I had no mother to take care of me. And I was just 22. And they gave us hamburger. Well, that was simply not out of the question, so I just didn't eat it. There was nothing I could eat. And then they very thoughtfully provided a date for me. Well, he was a monk. I didn't want anything to do with women from then on. And so then they took us out to a polo match or a horse race. I don't know what it was, but I sat as far away from her as I could. And I thought, no, I've got to. I was just still reading Autobiography of Yogi. When I finished it, I said, that's that. I took the next bus across America. It took me 4 days and four nights. And when I met him, the first words I addressed to him, I never dreamed I would address to any human being. I said, I want to be your disciple. And he accepted me that same afternoon. And since then, that was nearly 60 years ago. And I've been following that way ever since. I have to say that if he had not been truly somebody extraordinary, I think with my skeptical mind, I would not have been able to accept him. But he fitted everything I could possibly dream of in human perfection. Now, I do not want, and this is what most disciples do, they try to present their own guru as the greatest. There cannot be a greatest. When he accepted me, he said, God is your guru. He said, you are his disciples. I am just his instrument. And this, he rigidly maintained that attitude. He was only there, in a sense, as our servant, although he didn't act like that. He was so completely in himself. I have to say that living with him was like living with God. I couldn't help feeling in his presence this aura of incredible greatness and joy. He could be talking about a pothole that needed filling in the driveway, and I would feel this joy just overwhelming me. And I found that in his presence, there was a feeling that the spiritual path is real. There is no other reality. And that is what these great masters come into the world to help us to understand. God is not only a good alternative, he's the only possibility. There's no alternative. There is only God. And everything else is wasting time. And you may say, well, but I'm having a useful life. Yeah, okay, you can dream on if you like. But the final end of it all is that you came from him and you will never be satisfied in your heart until you know him. This is what life is all about. Now, the wonderful thing about him was because, for me personally, I had this, I have this sort of nature that if I find something good, I want everybody to know about it. And when I found this, I wanted everybody to know about his teachings. And I found that, I mean, I could have taken it happily if he had said, just be a hermit. I wanted to be a hermit too. But there was this other side of me that wanted to reach out and reach people. And I was a little bit aghast when he told me that you have a great work to do. Because I did want to be a hermit. But on the other hand, I did want to reach people. I thought, if this is so true, why keep it to myself? And so my life has been one of trying to share his message. I am nobody, but if I can, in some little way, bring about an understanding in people's minds of what he brought, is it different from what great masters have brought all through the ages? Yes and no. No, because truth is one and it's eternal. Sanatana Dharma, I've just finished a book on the revelations of Christ. And in that book, I point out that he taught Sanatana Dharma. Sanatan Dharma is not Hinduism. Sanatan Dharma is the religion of the entire universe. Every soul could be on the most distant galaxy, but every soul needs to understand that he, at his center is all the truth he seeks. It's sort of like, and this is an illustration I've used in this book, you have your karma of who knows how many incarnations, and it's like a great sheet of ice on a large lake. And you could have thousands of people on that lake trying to break through the ice, and they wouldn't succeed. But if you take one little drill and drill down at one point, you can get through the ice into the water. Then you can worry about the rest of the ice. And so our job as devotees, as seekers of truth, is not to worry about that burden of karma, is not to worry about what other people think and all the problems of the world and everything. If we can get through the ice at our little point, you know, science can never understand completely the mystery of one atom. Not possible. But there is one atom that you can understand, and that's the atom of your own little ego. You can trace it to your source, to its source, and understand that it is a manifestation of that infinite one. And once you have drilled through that ego and seen that this ego is really just a delusion, once you can do that, then you understand suddenly the whole universe. Because everything, there's no such thing as time and space. Days and nights of Brahma don't mean anything. The vastness of the universe with its 100 billion galaxies doesn't mean anything. It's all right here and right now. It's just as my guru said, on a little thought rests the cosmic lot. Rub that thought away and the universe is wiped away. You are the center of the universe as far as your ability to understand is concerned. It is no center. Center everywhere, circumference nowhere. The circumference that we need to get rid of is that little self-definition that says, I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm Indian, I'm American, I'm young, I'm old, I'm this, I'm that. All the things that people sort of pile up there, everybody in this world is a little bundle of self-definitions. And that bundle can get heavier and heavier, but it's still not he. And if you can once understand, you know, it can be your karma for a great safe to drop from a building on your head and kill you. But if you're not there, it won't kill you. The safe will fall, but it won't hit you. So your job is to reach that state of Jivan Mukta, as it's called, where the ego is overcome. And then, it may take you incarnations, but you are just as great as the greatest master in your inner understanding. This is the state of Nirvikalpa Samadhi. When you have understood that he is you, then you understand that he is everything. And then you still have your past karmas. You have to remember that you, as that person who may have been a pirate in one lifetime, or a businessman, or a mountain climber, all the many little things and dreams that people have, that it was God playing that role, God dreaming that ambition, God dreaming that fulfillment. And then if you can just relax and release it into God, you can get rid of the karma of an entire lifetime in one meditation, just in vision. Or you can just, even if you wish to, you can say, poof, it's gone. And it can be gone. It's all, at that point, my guru said, you don't really care. Because you know it's a dream, and you may keep a little bit of that dream to help bring you back to help other people. But this is the goal that we have to reach. And the particular thing about his teaching is, which I've discovered, is that he did come. I think of him truly as the avatar for this new age of energy. Because his whole teaching was centered in that thought of energy and showing people how the energy in our body, this is the true meaning of pranayama, not control of breath, but control of energy. And when you can control the energy in your body, then you can go into deep meditation, not until. And so bit by bit, I think it was a great advantage that I had never studied anything. Because when I came to him, I was a completely clean slate. I didn't have anything to unlearn. And I found that what he taught was absolutely staggering. I have to say further that I recognized it. You know, people can't teach you anything. They can help you to remember. This is what Patanjali says in his Yoga Sutras, that you reach the state, divine enlightenment is smriti. You remember that, oh yes, this is what I am. You feel divine joy, you feel divine love, and you say, well, of course, this is who I am. There's no such thing as getting out a notebook and thinking, oh, I mustn't forget this one. No, you just know. And so it is, when I met him, I knew. It was remembering and recognizing everything he taught. And I found that it was so thrilling, because I, who had done so much thinking, had come to realize that there was one answer, and he gave it, to all of the dilemmas of modern society. And for that reason, I have worked so hard to write books and so on. I'm not interested in writing books in my name, but I'm very eager to show how his teachings apply on all levels. What I found about him, people talk about his love, yes, but I found perhaps even more than love was his joy. He had an absolutely delightful sense of joy. It came out as a wonderful sense of humor. He could laugh delightedly at things and make you sort of join in the laughter, join in the fun. Life with him became not a lot of laughter, but just sheer delight. He was so kind to everybody and so sort of above it all. One time he came in his orange robes into a hotel, I think it was in Minneapolis, and a drunkard saw him and came up and embraced him like this. He said, "Hello, Jesus Christ." You know, they say, in vino veritas, in wine there is truthfulness or truth. And whatever it was, anyway, he saw something in this man, and Master saw that he had a good heart, but he was drunk. And so Master just gave him a little touch of his joy. And the man said, "Hey, what are you drinking?" Master said, "Well, it has a lot of kick in it." But the truth is that indeed, if you want to get out of any kind of delusion, just compare. I know one man told me he had taken Kriya Yoga initiation, and he was alcoholic. And he would sit down with a bottle of whiskey in one hand and his Kriya beads in the other hand, doing Kriya. And his friends said to him, "Well, what are you doing taking initiation when you can't even stop drinking?" And the man said, "Well, it's all right, but at least I can do one good thing. And I can't get rid of the bad thing, but I can do the good thing." And so after a while, one day, he thought, "Well, I feel so much joy in myself. What's this silly bottle doing?" He never touched it again. So try, compare. This world seems attractive only because you don't know anything better. But once you've got this something better, it is so delightful that nothing else matters. And this is what was wonderful about his life. He made that truth so attractive, so deeply meaningful, that I used to marvel that anybody could ignore it. And of course people do, because most people have their strong desires and so on. But the more you try, the more you will see that the way he showed is a way. I don't think that the rishis in the forests have much to say to Delhiites. I mean, here you are, you're stuck in a city, you can't go off to the forest. You can't brave the seclusion. You need normal things, or what you call normal things. It's not wrong. The important thing that he said was, cut down on that to give more time to God. And the more time you give to God, the more you find that these things don't really mean that much. And gradually you will find that you will begin not to want to be with those people who are involved in those things. And if Krishna said that out of 1,000, one seeks me, you can be one of that 1,000. If you just make a little step, the thing is to try. One time my guru had a vision where he was in a village, and behind him there was a high mountain. But he was facing the village. It was a marketplace, hot, dusty, crowded, shouting. Every now and then somebody would stop in front of him and look at the point behind him upwards, and then they would think, oh, but it's much too high for me, and they'd go back to their things. And finally, Master turned around to see what they were looking at, and he saw this beautiful mountain and a lovely garden on top, and such a contrast to that dirt and squalor and noise and confusion. And he thought, oh, how wonderful it would be to go there. And then the first thought came to him, but it's so high. And then he thought, well, but at least I can put one foot in front of the other. And putting one foot in front of the other, finally, he arrived at that beautiful peak. So don't think, oh, it's much too high for me. Oh, it's too difficult. Take one step at a time. And if you can't meditate a long time, meditate a little bit. I mean, you take a few minutes brushing your teeth. Why can't you take a little bit brushing your soul, too? Think about God. And you will find that bit by bit, it becomes intoxicating in a sense, but not in a bad sense, because it fills you with so much fulfillment that finally you know that's all it's about. You know, the one thing that's interesting is that there is in no field that you can imagine, can anybody say, I have found what I was seeking? Nobody. There's always the thought after you find what you were seeking, but if I only had a little bit more, if I only could do a little bit more, that little bit more is that whisper of the soul telling you, you want your own self. You know, I saw a ballet in New York, the Joffrey Ballet, once. I just happened to be there, and people had told me it was a good ballet to go to, and I was intensely dissatisfied. Some creative fellow had the idea that creativity must flow out of creativity, and so they had these dance movements that kept going out of one movement, another one evolved. They never came back to their center. Well, life is not like that. It was an unrealistic depiction of art. Art should always come back to its center, because that is what we do in life. We go out, then we have to come back. We go out, then we have to come back. Always, after every effort, you come back to yourself. You want to relax in old age. You want to have a place where you can retire. You want to have a place to come home again. That home is here. And if you can really just try to do that a little bit, you'll begin to see that there's no need to do all the things that people want. All you want, really, is Satchidananda. Everybody wants. He thinks he's going to find. There are two things that people want. One is to escape pain. The other is to find happiness. Escaping pain is what drives you to seek happiness. But happiness is not in this thing and that thing and the other thing. It's not outside yourself. It's inside. And the more you go inside, the more you find that this is the goal of life. Satchidananda. This is the trouble with Buddhism. Buddha was a great avatar. But as usually happens with his teachings, as happened with Jesus Christ, as happens with all great masters, and this is why you have all these masters coming back to get people straight. And you know, it's as if the goal of life were to go to the equator. And so people who are north have to go south to go to the equator. But because people are stupid, they go beyond the equator and they keep going south. And they meet other people who were told by their teachers, go north, go north. And they say, no, no, you're supposed to go south. No, you're supposed to go north. So they all fight. The goal is the same. People in the south have to be told to go north. People in the north have to be told to go south to reach the equator. And so you must reach that point of equilibrium in yourself. And people are always getting off balance. For example, in Buddhism, the idea of nirvana is correct. But nirvana does not mean nothingness. It means no thingness, and that's different. You still have consciousness. You don't have desires. You don't have ego. You don't have the thought that I need this or I need that or I define myself in this way or that way. When all those waves disappear, then what is left? Not nothingness, consciousness. And that's why Shankaracharya came to help correct people on that. And he said that, yes, there is a goal of life. That goal is Satchidananda, ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss, as my guru translated it. And this bliss we are always looking for, but because we seek it in the wrong way, we are disappointed. So if there was one thing that my Gurudev came to help people to understand, it was that with all your getting, get this understanding, as it says in the Bible. Get wisdom. Understand that the greatest miracle of all is love, unconditional love, that the people, even your enemies, are their your own self. Everything is your own self. This is what Swami Shivananda used to sign his letters, your own self. This is a wonderful statement. Think of everybody as yourself. Everybody longs for the same thing you want. Underneath all their seeking, what they want is bliss. Seek that bliss, then you will be a true